Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your illustrious host, Eddie Villanueva. Alongside me is my other illustrious host.
I was going to say, do I get to be illustrious too?
We get to be illustrious today.
Sweet.
Oh, by the way, this is Chad.
Chad. Hi, I'm Chad.
We're kind of in a celebratory mood right now because the Olympics are going on. And
love the Olympics.
Right now, the U.S. is ahead in medals, and we've been watching it all week, and then we realized like about 30 minutes ago, and we're like, oh, crap, we got to do a podcast today, Chad. And so we begrudgingly turned off the TV and had to run over here.
It was a really hard decision to make to turn that TV off and come here.
But we're here.
No offense to you, fair listeners.
Tis true. We are here, though, and we are excited because we have another great show in store for you. The Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live at VGB Studios every week. Yes, even during the Olympics.
That's right.
If you're ready to become a devoted Filmlosophan, you can subscribe to the podcast on your favorite platforms and download previous episodes from Libsyn, Audio Boom, Google Play, iTunes, Player FM, and Stitcher. That's right, I said Filmlosophan.
Filmlosophan.
We were talking about it. We're like, what do we call the people who watch the show? You know,
it's been far too long since we've decided what to do. I mean, what is this episode 23? Less than 23, right?
Less than 23.
The Magic Michael Jordan episode. So why not?
There you go.
It has nothing to do with Michael Jordan, but you know, that's what I think about.
But shout out to the guy if he's listening. So you can also connect with us on social media. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Keep track of movie news and announcements and share your thoughts about our latest review at any time. Also, check out our website at vgbstudios.com where you can find not only all our episodes, but our blogs and other great content, including episodes of the illustrious podcast that's on there hosted by our fly on the wall, Mr. Corey Vincent, Video Game Bang, and as well, me, Mike Self, and I.
You did it right.
That's right.
You got it.
I had to write it down, but hey.
See, it's all those Olympics, you know, gymnastics. You stuck the landing.
Exactly. You know, we've been watching too much synchronized swimming. But as I said, we had a great show in store for you today. And right at the top of that, of course, we always hit our movie news. At the very top, we got Patrick Stewart. So news about Professor X himself. Patrick Stewart says the Wolverine sequel may feature his last turn as Professor X.
Is that a pun? Last turn with the turn of the wheelchair wheel?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Although he might be walking around. You never know. Professor X kind of goes back and forth in the comics, at least.
That is true. I mean, in the Savage
Lands. Or if he's a mental
everything.
Projection and not actually physically with Wolverine by the time. You know, I mean, you never know.
You never know. But just as Hugh Jackman plans to become Wolverine one last time in James Mangold's untitled Wolverine sequel, it appears that Patrick Stewart will also be parking Professor Xavier's motorized wheelchair once his part in the film has wrapped.
I'm a little bit, you know, misty-eyed about this. I mean, before the X-Men movie came out,
before the Marvel franchise, it was
a glimmer in anybody's eyes, he was the perfect guy to play the role.
Oh, yeah.
When
no
it
doubt.
Came out, he was clearly the perfect guy to play the role. Mm-hmm. James McAvoy has done a good job of doing a young Xavier, but I just don't think anybody is going to be a more perfect fit than Patrick Stewart.
And you're talking about somebody who helped create the beginning of the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe that we have today.
Absolutely. The comic book movie renaissance, really. You already had some Batman films, Superman films, you know, a few other odds and ends here and there. But, I mean, this was the start of the renaissance.
Yeah.
And look where it is now.
According to an interview with ITV, Patrick's thoughts were pretty transparent on the subject matter. He says, I can't say because I don't know, but I would imagine this is probably the end of this franchise for me. But the thing about science fiction and fantasy is that you can never, ever say it's the end. It's over.
That is true.
So, I mean, if you look at the way X3 went about and then, you know, going from just cinematically going from X3 to Days of Future Past and whatnot, or even the end of the Wolverine, actually.
Yeah, where he went to Japan and then he's going back and suddenly you've got Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen waiting for him in the airport.
Yep.
Yeah. So, although they never paid that off. I was a little miffed about that. Like, wait a minute. That was a good setup.
It was. But, you know, like we said, he was a pretty much one of the solid pillars of what created this Marvel franchise that is today. And so seeing him go, it is kind of a downside, but that's not to say that maybe this could be possibly a publicity stunt. Maybe this is one of those things where, because if you want to really keep in mind, the Wolverine movies haven't really done all that great over the course of time. Maybe the second one did okay.
I was going to say the first one was just abysmal, is why.
Yeah.
And then people didn't trust it anymore.
And then the second one came out and it, some people kind of still stepped up and tried it, checked it out. Some people were like, okay, it's all right.
It was a beautifully made movie.
It was.
Visually, the shot composition, the pacing was pretty good. The story, maybe not what some mainstream fans were expecting from a Wolverine movie, because mm-hmm. it took place all in Japan, had the Yakuza and all that going on. But still, it was a very professionally made movie, which is not the impression that I got from X-Men Origins Wolverine, the first attempt.
So we shall see. And of course, if any news comes about it, we will bring it to you. Next on our list, The Chronicles of Narnia is getting a reboot. The Silver Chair heads to TriStar. So Disney set about adapting author C.S. Lewis's fantasy series with 2005's The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which was then followed by the sequels Prince Caspian and The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. But the franchise came to a halt soon after the 2010 release of Voyage and hasn't progressed in the ensuing years. This past January, however, Collider learned from producer Mark Gordon that the series was getting a reboot. Yeah. With an adaptation of the fourth book.
Say it again.
Adaptation? Reboot.
Reboot.
The fourth book, The Silver Chair, by Sony's TriStar Pictures. It's all going to be a brand new franchise, said Gordon. All original characters, different directors, an entire new team that this is coming from.
Very interesting that Disney would give something up, because they're having just moments ago talked about the X-Men film franchise. Mm-hmm. There's a pretty well-documented turf war between Disney and Fox over Marvel characters, even though it's all above board, because to get the different properties off the ground, Marvel sold film rights to different film studios. Mm-hmm. You had Spider-Man and his whole group of characters and storylines went to Sony.
Yep.
Right? Fox took X-Men and Fantastic Four and Daredevil, I believe. Daredevil was Fox, I think.
Daredevil was Fox.
And then some of those have since reverted back. So you get the phenomenal Netflix TV series Daredevil.
Yep.
Some of them have not. The X-Men franchise hasn't.
Fantastic Four hasn't.
Although Disney would love to have them back, because you can easily turn it into a huge cash cow. Here it's interesting, though. The Chronicles of Narnia series, even though it didn't do as well as they had hoped, especially the sequels, it's interesting that they would give it up at all, because their film rights sure don't run out until, I don't know, probably 2028.
Yeah.
2030, something like that. So the fact that they would give it up to a Sony-held film studio, TriStar, is really interesting.
And it makes you wonder, maybe there was a certain trade-off between Fox and Sony that this may have been the product of. Like, okay, we want this, and we're willing to give you this, and we know you have a director on contract who's possibly interested in doing a reboot of this.
Well, you know what it was. Spider-Man.
Well, I mean,
now they're sharing Spider-Man
with the Chronicles of Narnia. It really did step up the game for Disney in the live action genre. It really did kind of move things out a bit from the whole princess and damsel in distress thing. That whole just bubble that they've had at Disney, aside from their Pixar films and their animated features. To see it, though, go to Sony, I don't know, because the last thing I want, personally, and I know how the series goes for the Chronicles of Narnia, but the last thing I want is to see a film that I, grew up with, see a book series that I grew up with become like a really dark and almost young adult-ish type film that they're going to make, Like, I don't want to see...
Yeah, it depends. I don't remember The Silver Chair, to be honest with you. I don't remember the storyline, because it's been a little while, a few minutes, since I read these books. But the one thing I would hope for is if they have Aslan the Lion back in the movies, Liam Neeson, it's actually one of my favorite roles for him, even though you don't see him. I thought he was great.
Yeah, same here. And he just seemed to fit it perfectly. Like, I've honestly been waiting for... The Magician's Nephew to be made by Disney for the longest. That's one of my favorite books.
Is that the one where he creates everything? He like sing roars everything into existence?
And yeah, there's the pools that transfer to different universes and whatnot and so forth, and the whole origin of the White Witch and so forth. So, but yeah, I'm a little bit adamant because, you know, when you go to Sony, it tends to take a step above what it was meant for. And I thought Disney was a good place for Narnia, for the Chronicles of Narnia. I thought it was a really good place. But, I mean, hey, who knows?
Hey, don't knock it till you tried it.
Yeah. But ladies and gentlemen, speaking of adaptations, since we were talking about the Chronicles of Narnia, that actually brings us to our review today. Now, normally we review films that come out in theaters and things like that, but there's been this film that we're going to be talking about right now has had a special place in our heart for some time because we've talked about it on the show over and over. And that is the tale of The Little Prince.
Which, interestingly enough, also has a very odd recent history with behind-the-scenes work in the studios.
Yeah, it's true. We've talked about the struggle with Paramount and the whole distribution rights and so forth, and the jaw-dropping like decision to drop the distribution in the United States a week before it comes out.
Yeah, oddly enough, it's a French-made film because the story, it's a French author who wrote the children's book that many, many people are familiar with and love, and it's been around for a long time, The Little Prince. So it was originally, you know, produced by a French company, French vocal cast. They cast English-speaking, well-known actors to handle the English dubbing of the film. I thought it played really well. Felt very natural the way the mouths, you know, moved in sequence with the words. Paramount was the North American distribution studio, and kind of at the last minute they said, you know what, we're going to distribute it in Canada, but not in the United States.
Yeah.
And it just sort of like fell flat for no specified reason.
So we kind of put it to ourselves, we're like, you know what, when this movie comes out, we're going to give it its due justice, even though we're watching it, because it is available on Netflix, and so if you have Netflix, you can see it.
Yeah, Netflix saved the day.
It should have been in theaters. And that's the sad thing, is that it didn't make it, so we're going to give it its due justice and talk about it today. And that is The Little Prince, adapted from the classic tale by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. And directed by Mark Osborne, stars Jeff Bridges, Rachel McAdams, Paul Rudd, Marion Cotillard, James Franco, Benicio del Toro, Ricky Gervais, and Mackenzie Foy as the little girl. That is a pretty large cast.
It's a large cast, but most of them are not actually in it very much.
No.
The little girl and Jeff Bridges.
Little girl and Jeff Bridges. You know what? The one name that I didn't add to the list was the businessman, the individual. The voice of him was the same voice for Marlin from Finding Nemo.
Albert Brooks?
Albert Brooks. Mm-hmm. So Albert Brooks is in it as well. So, yeah. It has a pretty good size cast, and you can tell that the people who did jump into it, they're like, you know, this is kind of a labor of love. They're going to offer their time and so forth, but we'll get into that in a little bit. But flash synopsis of the story. A little girl lives in a very grown-up world with her mother, who tries to prepare her for it. Her neighbor, the aviator, introduces the girl to an extraordinary world where anything is possible, the world of the Little Prince. So one of the unique things about this film, and of course we've mentioned it actually in our movie news when we were talking about the Chronicles of Narnia, and even with X-Men is as well, fits in this same kind of category. But the one thing that we want to note about The Little Prince is that it is a film adaptation, is a film book-to-film adaptation. And even though the book is a French book, it is a book that not many people know about. I personally didn't know about it until you had mentioned it, and we talked about it on the podcast.
You never heard of it before?
I hadn't heard about it before, but...
Interesting. It's probably because for a while before this life, I was a teacher for a little while. So I ran across it because of other teachers that I was... I didn't actually know of it growing up or in my teenage years. It was more when I got into the professional world, I was reintroduced to a whole slew of children's books.
I know about stuff. Just kidding, I don't. No, but talking about adaptations, like we said, with Chronicles of Narnia being an adaptation from the book series.
Sure.
And then even the X-Men series being an adaptation of the comic books and cartoon series and whatnot.
Yeah, Hollywood gets a lot of its ideas from other mediums, other formats.
I would say we're even in an era of adaptations right now with so much going on. But film adaptation, by definition, a film adaptation is the transfer of a written work in whole or in part to a feature film. It is a type of derivative work. A common form of film adaptation is the use of a novel as the basis of the feature film, which is what The Little Prince is based off of.
Sure.
And so, talking about film adaptations, there's been so many films throughout the course of cinema history that have been adapted from novels, from literary works, from... It's pretty much been inspired by something else.
Absolutely, yeah.
And several famous films over the years have been adaptations from the more recent Harry Potter series, which is probably one of the more famous ones. You know, you have Harry Potter, The Lord of the Rings. Those are some of the bigger ones. To even the iconic 1939 classic, Gone with the Wind.
Yep, it was a book first.
It was a book first. You know, and so forth from there, you know, you have...
The Wizard of Oz, book first.
The Wizard of Oz. A lot of the Disney films from pretty much 1932, I want to say.
39? Snow White?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, somewhere.
It was in the 30s.
In the 30s, yeah.
But that film itself was an adaptation from a storybook and in the classic
so
story.
So many of its classic
exactly.
films.
Exactly. Just about every Disney film from 1930s all the way up till 1989 when they did The Black Cauldron, I believe, they've all been pretty much adaptations. So you may not have known it, you may not have recognized it, but there may be novelizations actually of the stories that you're seeing in the films, you know, nowadays, or you know, classic tales that you watch.
Well, and the beautiful thing when you're talking about film adaptation, a lot of times people will kind of go toe to toe with, oh, well, they left out this part, or they did this other part differently than the way it was written in the book. And one of the important things to realize when you're watching any adaptation, be it for television, for the stage, for the big screen in the movie theater, you know, whatever it is, a radio show back in the day, they did radio teleplays where they adapted things. You have to still work with the medium that you're presenting it in.
Yeah.
And you've got to do things that are unique to that medium. And one of the things that The Little Prince does, which is a significant departure from the storybook itself, is it introduces a completely different storyline as the A story, if you will. So a lot of times when you are talking about the mechanics behind movies or TV shows, you'll have an A story and a B story. And the A story is, what is the main character doing? What are the things that affect him or her? The B story involves side characters. And it's interesting in this film that most of the focal, the time spent focusing on a character is focusing on the little girl who's in the modern world. Her world is computer animated. That's the format that it's presented in.
Yeah.
She meets the aviator when he's already an old man. And it's her story that you're following. She is experiencing a new life. She and her mother move so that she can be closer to the school that her mother wants her to get into and have a good life. It's all planned out for her and everything. And the aviator introduces her to the world of the little prince because he wrote the story. In the storybook, the aviator and the little prince are the main characters.
They're the
really the
focus.
Little prince is the main character. The aviator is the narrator and author of the story.
Yeah.
So here in the movie, we see now that they've adapted it to film, they've introduced a completely other extrapolation, a larger story within which it's almost like they're kind of, in a way, reading the storybook to you over the course of the film.
Yeah.
And they introduce, you know, new elements throughout. Devotees who actually do know the story and love it might have some issue with a few of the liberties that they've taken for the film medium. But the thing that I think that they did really interestingly in this one is the two sides, if you will, the new story, the A story, and the old story, the treasured classic, the B story, they're actually presented almost entirely in two different formats.
Yeah.
So you've got computer animated for the modern world with the girl and the aviator as an old man. And then in these flashbacks, or it's kind of like the storybook actually comes to life for her. Those sequences dealing with the little prince and the aviator when he was younger, those are done in stop motion animation, which was stunning to look at.
Yeah. And talking about, you know, book to film adaptations, it brings up, especially when it comes to Little Prince, it brings up a couple of key things that, you know what, a lot of people should keep in mind, because that is one thing. You bring up a great point as far as earlier in what you were saying. A lot of people do come to to seeing a film. They come to see their favorite story being adapted to the film, or they come to see, you know, something that they've read about or so forth in some media format. And they experience it, and usually the first thing that comes out of their mouth is, well, they forgot this and they forgot that.
Right.
And there's a lot of things that people will continue to complain about. There's no film right now that I know of that has 100% everything that was in the book in the film. I have yet to see one.
One of my very favorite, this is a personal life story. So a good friend of mine who loves to cook, we all got into The Hunger Games as a book before it was a movie. Got into the whole series, had read the books. The first movie comes out, we go to see the movie, and at the end of the movie, right when the credits start rolling, this very dear friend of mine said, well, they didn't put much emphasis on the lamb stew. Because in the book, there was, you know, there were quite a few pages detailing how much Katniss loved the flavor, and it was something that she receives over the course of the games to feed to Peeta when she's rehabilitating him from an injury in a cave and all this stuff. And it does have some significance in the book. And, you know, it was just funny because you're sitting there thinking, well, no, in a movie, you wouldn't spend a lot of time looking at a bowl of stew.
No.
You're not in her head where she's explaining all the significance that it has for her, and she wouldn't, the character that Katniss is, she wouldn't do it. But it was one of those moments of like, this is what really connected in the book, you know, to my friend.
Yeah.
Our friend, common friend, mutual friend. But it wasn't something that would translate easily or well into the medium of film.
That's true.
And that happens all the time when you're adapting works. And sometimes it's because we don't have the budget to pull something like that off, so we're going to do something a little more tame if it's an action-adventure story. Or like here, they've actually added to the story because maybe the storybook itself, if you just adapted that, you wouldn't get a feature-length film.
True. And it's funny that you mentioned that because our mutual friend also, after that, scoured the entire face of the internet to look for a recipe so that she could make it herself.
And she did. She found it and she made it, and it was very good.
But that then brings up a very key question. It begs to ask us, what are some key things that make a good book to film adaptation? So right off the bat, the first thing I can think of is respect to the source material. So you know what you're creating a film about. You know what you're going to be filming. You know where the story is coming from. You understand the author's point of view. You understand what exactly was the mindset when this book was being written and when it was being read. And when you understand that and you respect that and you have that fully in mind at the forefront of everything, those, I believe, are some of the first beginning steps to creating a proper adaptation. In my mind.
As you writers, definitely would start there.
Yeah, as writers, myself, I'm a journalist and Chad does screenplay. From a writer's perspective, understanding your subject matter and being able to have enough research to where you wouldn't have to revisit the you know, said incident, or like if you're writing something on a particular incident, or if you're writing anything on a particular moment in time, you don't have to revisit the moment. You can do your due diligence. You do your research, you do your homework, you do your time invested into it.
Well, and quite frankly, at the end of the day, you pay your respect to, especially if you're writing something for a mass audience that could actually get you a lot of money, right? You could get paid significantly for somebody else's ideas.
Yeah.
And so you want to pay your respects. Now, does that mean that you follow lockstep with exactly the way that things happen? Mm-mm. No, because the mediums are different. And if you do have a book like The Hunger Games, where it's all, most of that first book is in her head as a character. It's her thought process, not her words and not her actions all the time. So you've got to find ways to translate that onto the screen without losing the heart of it.
Yeah.
I think more important than the sequence of events necessarily being the same, because again, you can change the format and have the same core story. You could tell if a book happens chronologically beginning to end, and you want to start your movie in the middle and have the beginning sequences occur as flashbacks, sometimes that can really add to the flavor of the film version of the story.
Yeah.
And it really does enhance the experience. So you don't have to march in lockstep with the sequence of events, but you've got to stay true to the heart and to the tone of the source material. If you lose that, then even if you gain part of a mainstream audience, you're going to lose the people that were devoted to it to begin with.
Yeah. And secondly on that list, right after respecting the source material, you have to choose your right cast. And not just, you know, your lead actors, but even the side roles, the side characters, the people who really help create that foundation for your lead character. One of the things that comes to mind when you were saying Hunger Games was I was thinking, in my mind, one of the key things that kind of helped me stay in focus with the films in the Hunger Games was that they got the cat right. Now, mind you.
Yeah, my least favorite character. Yes.
But the fact remains is that, I mean, they could have totally ixnayed that out of the story, or they could have, you know, downplayed it a lot more, but they were true to the way the cat looked in the story. They're true to the way the story
sure
talked
were
about.
Through three films.
Yeah. And for me, having that, even
four
even,
films. Excuse
four
me.
Films,
four films.
Yeah. Even as an animal, they picked the right one, and it helped build those stories, especially towards the end of the films. You know, when you got your fourth film and you have those moments with Katniss and the cat, and they're going back and forth, you know, and she's upset and she's just, you know, venting to the cat. The moment makes it much more solid for me as the cat looks exactly how I envisioned when I read the story.
Sure.
And that goes for every, you know, supporting character and lead character as well. When you create a story and you build it and you add in the right elements of the actors and the actresses, that then continues to move forward with the right mindset of a great film adaptation.
Definitely. In this movie, I think very much in addition to choosing the right actors, which it's interesting, you do have a lot of famous names attached to the movie. Many of them have like two lines,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe four.
Yeah.
But and you do tend to recognize their voices when those characters are speaking. Although I thought Benicio del Toro was Christoph Waltz, so what do I know? But he has two lines. Come on, people. Give me a break. But at the same time, like you said, when things appear or feel the way that you expected them to, I think that's what the magic in this film I thought was really in the stop motion animation.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it was because it looks like the storybook came to life.
Yeah.
It looks like you made a three-dimensional version of those hand-painted figures in the original storybook. And you had movement and motion and everything. Not necessarily a whole lot of talking from them. But they looked right and they felt very authentic to the story that you're used to seeing on the page. And then, of course, they do have the voices and they sound fine. They sound genuine to the animated style. But I thought the style itself really sang in those stop motion pieces.
Yeah. And finally on the list, I think one of the most quintessential things that you would have for anybody who's looking to make a book-to-film adaptation is you want to be able to present the true essence of the original story in a way that makes sense in the film. Now, watching a movie about the Hunger Games and have it take place in the future and whatever and totally moving away from the main focus of the story, I mean, you probably could, but if you're not true to what the story is about, kind of like what we said about respecting the source material, then ultimately you're not making a Hunger Games film. You're just making your own interpretation of something else. It goes back to the age-old cinematic age-old argument about the dispute that Stanley Kubrick had with Stephen King in creating the 1970s horror film The Shining. The film was made, and when it came out, Stephen King said he hated it to the T. He couldn't stand it. And Stanley Kubrick said, well, he wasn't making his film. He was making his own film. He just used the inspiration from the book.
Right, that's where you get farther from the adaptation into the spectrum and more into the derivative.
Yeah.
And, I mean, by definition, an adaptation is derivative, but then there's, like, really deviating.
Yeah. And so, you know, having these key things, it really does help keep in mind when you're going to go see a book-to-film adaptation film. These are the types of things you want to have in mind. You want to have these things. Did the director do these things? Did they respect the source material? Did they choose the right actors? Did they actually present the true essence of the story that we were looking to see, that we've known?
Yeah, there's nothing. There are a few letdowns in a movie, in a movie-going experience. There are fewer letdowns that are worse than something that you knew what to expect,
mm-hmm.
and they got it wrong.
Yeah.
And you just sit there the whole time, and you're like, oh, but this isn't what it should be. Mm. This is not what it should be. And then you leave dissatisfied.
Yeah.
And inevitably, then you go out and you don't recommend it to your friends and family because it's not what it should be.
Or even worse, you miss out on an opportunity where the sequel could possibly shine much better than the first one, but you're already in the mindset that you're not going to invest any more time because of the first experience.
Sure, and I'm not very familiar with this particular book series, but The Golden Compass, I've known people who were very fond of that book series, and the first movie was just a total loss.
Yeah.
I thought, as a person who wasn't familiar with the series, it was a terrible movie.
Mm-hmm.
But then the people who knew and loved the book series, it was an even worse experience for them, because it didn't do its job in respecting the source material.
Yeah. So in regards to the Little Prince, you know, the film does open up. Like we said, there's a child and her mother who are in this really diehard set schedule where they want to get into this private school. There's a school that she wants to get her daughter in, so she sets her up on this extremely strict schedule to make sure that she is on par with where she wants her life schedule to go.
Like, she literally plans every minute of her daughter's life through high school graduation. And the girl is like 8, 7.
And everything is super systematic. The film tries to make that very apparent in the very beginning, that the world they live in is very systematic. And so while this little girl is sitting in her bedroom going over some very extremely foreign mathematical equations, suddenly she is hit by a little paper airplane, and she opens it up and recognizes that it seems to be a story that was written, and recognizing that it's from the old man who lives next door, who happened to had his plane propeller fly through a fence and into their sidewall and into their kitchen
right after they've moved in, basically the first day that the mom has gone to work and the little girl is home alone, and this big old airplane propeller comes crashing through the house.
Yeah. And so she receives this little paper airplane, and she looks at it. She looks at the old man. The old man waves, and all of a sudden she closes the window and crumples the paper and throws it in the garbage.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of – it's his way of an apology.
Yeah.
An initial apology to her for, you know, scaring her and breaking part of their house and everything. And then he's also giving it to her as a gift.
Is it just me, or does it seem like more and more Jeff Bridges is becoming like the iconic old man voice for most? It seems like every time I hear Jeff Bridges speak or whatever, he doesn't really have any other type of voice other than that, like, older. I know he's up there in age.
He's an interesting guy, because he's not the same it's not the same old man voice that you get from, like, Clint Eastwood.
No.
Right? Gritty, grungy, you know, don't take no stuff from nobody kind of curmudgeon.
Yeah, this is
But it's also not like Santa Claus, warm, jolly, you know, grandfatherly figure. He's got this eccentricity, and he's even better when you, like, see him in a live performance, because he works the eccentricities into the nonverbals of the character as well, whatever character it is, Rooster. And, you know, but it's a delight. I think he's definitely, I could listen to him for hours. I could certainly watch him do whatever he does while he's talking for hours, because he has such a it's really subtle in a way, but it's extremely distinct at the same time.
Yeah. And just a quick side note, Jeff Bridges is actually the man crush for Corey, as he's the guy who plays in one of Corey's favorite movies, which is, if you can't see it, but it's plastered in this studio all over the place, The Big Lebowski. So just quick shout out. But so
The dude abides.
So we got Jeff Bridges. We got Rachel McAdams, who plays the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the slew of other characters. You have Ricky Gervais, who plays the conceited man, according to the story. You got several other people that we'll once we continue to go down, we'll name them out.
Yeah, so essentially, there are a lot of players in the film. They're almost all punctuation marks in the story. Because the story ultimately, it works as both the real life experience of this little girl and an allegory of humans in general and the different paths that we may or may not choose for our lives or have chosen for us, as is the case in the beginning with her mother is just telling her what to do and has set this giant, you know, organized calendar schedule thing for her whole life. But really at the heart of it, it's the story of these two characters of the aviator as an old man and the little girl. And the beautiful thing is that that entire dynamic and element is unique to the movie.
Yes.
It's not in the original storybook. But it very much parallels in many ways the story that is in the storybook between the aviator when he's younger and the little prince he's traveling between worlds.
Yeah. And so after that sequence, the little girl, which, by the way, we're not just calling her the little girl because of the fact that we don't know her name. She's literally listed in IMDb and in the film as the little girl. So the little girl somehow ends up deciding to read the story after she finds a bunch of little figurines and so forth that were in this large jar of pennies to pay for the damages that the old man did to the house.
Yeah, he doesn't really earn an income or anything, so he just goes into his back room and grabs a giant jar of, I think they were like francs.
Yeah, they were francs.
But they're pennies.
Yeah.
In English.
So she decides to read the story. She gets engrossed into the story, and she decides to make the trek across the other side of the fence, the hole that was made by the propeller. She crosses through and recognizes the propeller that's attached to the airplane that is in his backyard. So the gentleman has an airplane in his backyard, and she ends up meeting him. They end up hitting it off, and they become really great friends almost instantaneously.
Yeah, very, very quickly.
And he begins to show her the rest of the story. He begins to reveal to her the rest of the story and the different pages that he himself has. He wrote out and he drew and so forth. And he hands them to her because apparently the aviator has not been able to share his story with anybody.
Yeah, he kind of doesn't have any friends, sadly enough. Everybody avoids him.
So during the course of this time, their friendship blossoms and they grow during the course of the summer. And it becomes apparent towards the end of the summertime that he is hoping that she understands the purpose of the story, because at one point in time, as he says to her, he plans on not being there anymore. He plans to go back with the little prince. And so once he announces this to her, she becomes upset. And so to kind of remedy the situation that he caused because she's upset, they decide that there's a place that they can go where they give pancakes for free on your birthday, which it's not her birthday, so she has to lie. So they jump in a car that looks like hadn't started in almost 20 years. The car has grass growing in the back seat with flowers.
Yep, flat tires.
Flat tires.
Backfires a few times.
And so as they're driving, the old man ends up running into a bunch of stuff and so forth and ends up getting pulled over and apparently doesn't have a driver's license. We later find out that he has been pulled over 4 times previous to this, to which he had his license taken away from him. And so she is forbidden to see him, and he is forbidden to be anywhere near her. And so at this point, one of the biggest things that is great about this film is, you had mentioned earlier, the use of the transitioning formats that you have from the 3D, like CGI, I guess.
It's computer animated, just, you know, like your Kung Fu Panda and your Shrek
and all
that. Your
Pixar standard kind of deal. And then you have it transition in the very beginning, which is so great. When it's telling the story of the little prince, it transitions to almost like paper stop motion.
Yeah, it's very, very paper-like texture.
The way where the people are facing, you can tell that it's paper. You can tell that the stop motion was done really, really well, but it's a beautifully done segment because it's only in the very beginning, because then it transitions over to like actual figurines of stop motion. And
it's interesting because they do things to make it, the paper kind of gets you into the world because they have different layers that you're kind of traveling through. But even the way the figurines are done, because the original illustration in the storybook is, I believe, watercolor.
Yeah.
It's, you know, very muted tones, very soft and pleasant to look at. And so they're trying to make this stop motion world mimic that watercolor appearance in the way that they make their figurines and have them move around and all of that.
And one of the biggest things that you recognize with this particular these particular segments, because it really does pop out more in the storytelling parts rather than anything else, are the colors that they use, the usage of bright tones, the contrasting colors. You have the sand, obviously, in certain scenes when the aviator goes down, and that whole sequence. But then you have the
young aviator. His past, he crashed in the Sahara Desert, and that's where he met the little prince for the first time.
Yeah. And then you have those contrasting colors of with the flowers, and you have the contrasting colors of the yellow, and even with what the little prince is wearing, the deep greens that he's wearing and the bright yellows, and how it contrasts to the world that's around him. And when he's visiting the other asteroids where other people live, and you recognize the voices. And as we said, we would mention, you know, Ricky Gervais plays a conceited man who just thrives on attention.
Yeah, he thinks that he's the greatest, and it's because he lives on a quote-unquote planet, a little asteroid, all by himself.
Oh, yeah.
And so he just wants applause all the time.
Then you have the king. I forget who voices him, but you have the king.
Who says he has power over everything, but he only decides to order the sun to set when it's already time for the sun to set.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very clever.
You have the businessman who you were you had mentioned was Albert Brooks. I couldn't forget mm-hmm. remember the name, but that's who it was. Albert Brooks plays the businessman. And, of course, the other characters you
and he
have,
thinks that he can own all the stars. So if he yeah. can count the stars in the sky, then whatever he's counted, he owns. And that gives him worth and value. So he is owning all the stars.
And then, of course, as we were saying, or as Chad mentioned earlier that he didn't catch, you have Benicio del Toro, who voices the snake, which, of course,
he is on Earth. When the little prince finally gets to Earth, he meets the snake.
True dat. And then you also have the fox, who is voiced by James Franco.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a very...
Well, and you have... Don't forget the rose. The rose the is rose like the is most important.
Marion
she
Cotillard.
Kicks off the whole journey.
Yes.
So the little prince also lives on an asteroid by himself,
mm-hmm.
right? And he has a routine he follows during the day. And one day, there's a rose that appears or grows. And there's a kind of a there's a loving relationship, but it's in a way kind of codependent, because the rose, being so beautiful, is very vain, and she mm-hmm. wants his attention, and he's a little put off by it. And so eventually they kind of are in a bit of a lover's spat, and he takes off with this flock of birds that he has, kind of like a string of balloons that he flies away on, and yeah. he visits all these other worlds, asteroids, and ends up on Earth. And the whole time he's learning, you know, what really matters
yeah.
in life. Is it your accomplishments? Is it the adoration of other people when they look at you? Is it your power? What is it that truly matters? And it's this whole journey for him to ultimately discover that he needs to return to his world to be with his rose again. Yeah.
And of course, another thing that's a really big... A big player in this film, and you actually got a chance to hear it a little bit ago, is the music and the score of the film overall. It really is a subtle and very trance-like piece that flows throughout the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
And it really plays on that, you know, youth innocence type feel. So I really enjoyed that. I know you did as well. So the film continues on, and as we move forward after that scene, they're not allowed to see each other. She's been told that, obviously by him, that there's going to be a point where he's going to be gone. And she, after that whole separation, she ends up focusing. Her mom gets upset and has her focus back on her studies. And the days roll down to the final 2 days, I believe.
And before the school year starts.
Before the school year starts. And on the second to last day, while driving home in a rainstorm, she realizes there's an ambulance out front of his house. And she goes nuts. She loses it. She gets out of the car in the middle of the rain. Realizes that the old man was taken in the ambulance, and she ends up stealing a bike in the middle of a rainstorm and rides the bike like heck to the hospital, which apparently the hospital wasn't that far away because she got to it pretty quick.
Yeah, she was pretty much right behind the ambulance.
Yeah, for the entire time. And she realizes that the old man is going to be going away, in quotations, going away. And so she needs to find the little prince so that they can see each other, and
she basically wants, she doesn't want to lose the aviator, the old man aviator. she knows that he wants to go and be where the little prince is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's indications based on the story that she's been told that the little prince isn't here, quote unquote, because he allowed himself to pass on in a way. He wanted to return to his rose mm-hmm. up on his planet in space. And thanks to the snake, he knew that he couldn't do that in his current form, in his current shell.
Mm-hmm.
So the snake bites him and he disappears and presumably goes back to his world. So now the aviator, for the rest of his whole life, he's been waiting for the day that he will share this story with somebody who gets it, who can pass it along to other people. And he will then, once he's accomplished that, he will then go and pass on and be where the little prince is.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's worried that that means that he's going to pass away. She doesn't want that to happen. So she decides that to avoid having her friend pass away, she's going to travel into space or wherever in his airplane and go and find the little prince and bring him back to be with the aviator so they can be together.
So the final part of the story kind of entails how she attempts to fly the plane to where the prince is to go find it. And so the story ensues there. I mean, we're not going to ruin for you because it's a great ending. It's a great story that follows.
Well, this is really the truly new component.
Yeah, this is where the modern take on the story and where it goes from what people have read from the storybook. It goes on further from the own director's interpretation from
And it's a really interesting, I mean, it's an interesting expansion, let's say.
Yeah.
Derivative part of the narrative.
So, all in all, you know, the film ends well. It does give us a sense of satisfactory as we see the closing of the ending and the way the story closes. You know, we're not going to ruin it, like I said. But I think, personally, from what I've heard about the story, I feel like it does give that type of respect to the story, in a sense. In my mind, from what I've read about, I like I said, I haven't fully read the story, but you're more of the, I guess, expert in this one as far as knowing sure. whether or not if it did do
justice.
Yeah,
I think it's extremely respectful. It's number one thing to know, American audience members, Paramount executives probably factored this into their decisions to sell to Netflix instead of put it in the theaters themselves. But it does feel very French.
Mm-hmm.
The pacing is a bit different than what you would see in your typical computer animated movie for kids. The story points sometimes are left a bit ambiguous. It's meant to make you think, which is part of the reason why people love the book, is because it's a kid's book, but it works for people at all different levels and stages of life because it's a fable. I mean, at its heart, it's a one giant fable, and it's, you know, fetchingly so. But the movie, I think, is very truthful in tone to the feel of the book. And in a way, it's one of those, it has a lot of elements that are very different. The whole modern storyline, all of that is very different and doesn't appear in the book, but it's almost as if you're telling the same story twice at the same time, and you're making sure that a modern audience has every opportunity to connect with, you know, quote unquote, the moral of the story.
And I think in that particular sense, if you have, for people who are fans, who are aware of what the story is about, it kind of has a sense of redundancy slightly to it when you're engaged into the story, and then you're realizing that the duplicate story is happening parallel to it with the little prince or so forth. So it does tend to feel slightly like that, but I think overall it is a slower paced film, but I still fully enjoyed it. And I believe you did as well. We both saw it at the same time.
I did. Well, and it kind of gets you a little bit. I mean, if you're willing to handle the slightly different pacing and more cerebral processing of, you know, whatever life, it looks beautiful, especially the stop motion. Looks amazing. I wish they would have done the whole movie that way, but I see why they didn't.
Yeah.
And the music, like you said, it's kind of trance-like. It's inviting and provocative at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So, right at the top, Chad, does it pass or fail, and how many monocles?
Eddie, it definitely passes, and I will say...
He even yodeled at the end of that
3.75 monocles.
3.75, all right. As far as myself, I do give it a pass for all the reasons that I said. Of course, it is a slower pace, type film, but I actually enjoy films like that that actually have a valid story to tell. So it works for me. As far as Monocles, I would give it a 3.5. You know, it's definitely a film that people will be drawn to, and it'll definitely catch the eye of certain literary fans of literature and so forth. But all in all, it's still a specific taste.
It's a much better adaptation of a childhood favorite than, say, The Smurfs.
There you go. But that brings us to our special segment of today. And that is, ladies and gentlemen, the Filmlosopher's final countdown.
It's the final countdown.
What was that? Did you hear that?
I think I recognize that guy's voice.
Wait a second. Maybe he'll come back. Hold on. Hold on. Give me a second.
Are you there? Hello?
It's the final countdown.
There's the guy. Yes. All right. Yeah, guys, you know, discussing this film, one can't help but become nostalgic of previous films that have adapted some beloved stories to the big screen. So, we're going to have a final countdown here on the Filmlosophers. Man, I almost got tongue-tied on our own name. Here on the Filmlosophers, each of us are going to be listing our top three best film adaptations. Like we said, we listed a couple other ones previous to this, and of course, it doesn't necessarily have to be a children's adaptation, but it does have to have some form, some foundation in literature first before it came to the big screen. I would say is the only one stipulation right off the bat.
Sure. Mine are all children's books.
His are all children's books. And looking
because
at
otherwise,
list,
I'd have a list of like 20.
So I'll tell you what, since you got a great size list, what is your number three?
My number three choice, Eddie, was the film Big Fish.
Big Fish?
Yes.
Starring Ewan McGregor. Rachel McAdams, I believe.
Jessica Lange. Let's see. Who else? Albert Finney.
Mm-hmm.
Not Albert Brooks, but Albert Finney, who was phenomenal in that movie, by the way. Danny DeVito,
I was going to say.
He's got the really big, tall, giant guy whose name I don't know because that's the only film I've ever seen him in.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a few others. But it was just – I love it because it was – it had that – you know, it was Tim Burton, so it had that oddity to it. It had that – really unique textures, and the characters were all very distinctive, not always in a likable way, but it was ultimately a very likable film, and it definitely, the first time I saw it, it totally brought a tear to my eye in the movie theater, which, you know, give me all the feels, I gotta give it some high marks.
True dat.
What about you, Eddie? What's your number three?
You know, my number three, I'm gonna have to go to a little bit more of a more... I guess you can say cerebral type film, and I know I just mentioned it as far as not being a great one because the director didn't like it, but I have to go with my roots and I have to go with horror, and my number three is The Shining, starring Jack Nicholson.
You and I are going to have very different lists here.
Oh,
my friend.
You know, you have no idea.
I like Big Fish. I like The Shining.
I loved this movie because
typical
of the fact that, because of the fact that Stanley Kubrick took his own mindset and he took his own view, mind you. Of course, it kind of got a lot of people upset. It got Stephen King upset, and the man's a writer, you know? Who upsets writers nowadays?
Well, it's not nowadays anymore, though. You know? It was back in the day.
It was back in the day. But to say the least, Stanley Kubrick took his own take on a very, very different story other than what was expected with The Shining. You know, it's more focused on
Have you
boy.
Read the book? Do you know what the differences were?
Oh, yeah. There's two of them, actually. There's The Shining, and then the second one, which is based primarily on Danny, the little boy. But that's my number three. Chat, you're number two.
My number two. Again, I'm restricting mine specifically to children's books turned into movies. My number two is Shrek. I'm not going to say the entire series because it did kind of dwindle in likability for me. But the first one I remember was just really fun, unique, a different take on that whole fairy tale motif. And I actually hadn't read the book and didn't know the book existed until after the movie came out. So it made me want to go read it.
Not bad.
Number two for you.
Number two. I gotta go with another classic. It's not in the horror franchise, but still, it is a very gritty and very awesome film. The Godfather. The first Godfather was a novel adaptation. It was incredibly done. Marlon Brando, top notch. I loved it. It was one of the great ones. Yeah, we're gonna have two
separate
lists.
I'm just like, I'm still stunned by the difference, especially when you hear my number one.
All right.
I mean, we go from The Godfather to
Number one, drum roll, please.
Here we go. I almost don't want to say it. You're going to laugh at me.
I probably will.
The Mini Adventures of Winnie the Pooh.
The Mini Adventures of Winnie the Pooh.
So Winnie the Pooh was a staple in our house in my childhood. We owned the VHS back in the day. Youngsters who are listening, I'm old. So we had VHS and we had, I don't know, 7 or 8 of them. However many had been made by the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we watched him and watched him and watched him, and just the mentality of that weird looking little yellow bear. I don't even know how good of an adaptation it is of the source material. I've never read a Winnie the Pooh book, but those classic cartoons, I would turn into a child if you turned it on in front of me right now. I would turn into Winnie a 6 or 7 year old. And I would sing along because I know the words.
All right, and my number one. I don't hear a drum roll. I'm just saying. There we go. My number one, I'm going back to my roots again. And we're going back to Stephen King again. And we are doing 1990s Misery.
Oh, my
gosh. I love that
film.
I love that film. Kathy Bates, James Caan, the only two people in the entire film pretty much that take up the majority of the screen time. It is a wonderful masterpiece that I love. And, of course, who can forget the time when James Caan's legs go whoop, whoop, both turn in on themselves on a wooden block?
Whoop, yeah. Whoop. Was that the actual Foley artist sound effect?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
whoop,
yeah.
Whoop, whoop.
They took it from a Three Stooges episode.
Yeah, yeah, that's what it sounds like.
So those are our top three.
I think this is a Three Stooges episode, and it's just two of us.
Those are the top three. Each of us, our own top three best film adaptations. If you have any questions, or you know what, if you think we were wrong or right, or if you like any of our list, or you have your own list, drop us a line on our comment page on facebook.com/filmlosophers, or even on our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Before we go, we're going to leave you with a few movie bites. Resident Evil, the final chapter's trailer, goes back to where it all began. So they're starting it all over again. Well, hopefully not. They're going to
reboot?
No. Let's hope not. Me and Mr. Corey Vincent were looking at it earlier, and you know, it looks okay, but I have to honestly say, I hope this is the last one, because...
Well, with a name like The Final Chapter, it should be.
Who knows? Tom Hiddleston teases Loki's return in Thor Ragnarok with first Instagram post. So we know that Loki's coming back, and he's going to have a presence there because he's obviously Tom Hiddleston's dressed up as Loki.
Yeah, which is very interesting because you and I took a trip to Australia.
That we did.
About a month ago, a little more than a month ago.
That we did.
And at the tail end of our visit, Tom Hiddleston and girlfriend Taylor Swift arrived in Australia.
Yeah.
Where he was apparently only prepping with like training and stuff because he's just now getting into costume as the character.
Yeah.
Or they had him wait for a few weeks before he posted the picture. Who knows?
Who knows? Lastly, the Man of Steel sequel now in the works at Warner Brothers. So it looks like they finally picked up the film to, you know, re-throw it back into the whole DCCU. So, you know, I personally thought Man of Steel was by far better than BVS and... as of right now, probably better than Suicide Squad. But, you know, hey, if they're it's not the greatest film, but if they're looking for a viable work to continue off of, I'd say that'd probably be the best.
Sure, and they're talking about shopping for a different director, which is fine, because mm-hmm. Snyder's going to have his hands full anyway. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see, with a different creative mind kind of driving the car,
mm-hmm.
where it might go.
But that about wraps up another show. And of course, like I said, if you have any thoughts on a review, or if you agree with us, or if you disagree with us, let us know on our Facebook page and our Twitter page. We're always open to discuss, and we're always willing to go back and forth and have a great discussion with you. As always, you know, if you can, check out all the other episodes that we have on VGBstudios.com, where you can find our podcast as well as Video Game Bang and me, Mike Self, and I.
Look at that. He didn't even have to look at the notes on
I
that
I wasn't
one.
Even looking. I'm like, wow. That's not in our notes, but we got to throw that in there. But of course, thanks again for listening in. And as always, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.